go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, and welcome along, everybody. We are going to jump right to the chase this evening. I have on the line with me right now, graciously agreeing to have a conversation with us about a very, very, very important thing that has happened today. An absolutely stunning study has been announced. It has been published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. And the fact of the matter is, what this study indicates is that mountaintop removal is pervasive. It is irreversible. And this is real science. This is the undeniable stuff. And I have several of the co-authors of the study online with me now. I want to go straight to them so that we waste no time whatsoever. On the line with me now is Dr. Margaret Palmer. Dr. Palmer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Also with us, Dr. Michael Hendricks, Dr. Emily Bernhardt, and Dr. A.D. Lemley, all of whom had a hand in the creation of this study. Dr. Palmer, and each of you, when you speak, if you would just identify yourselves, please. Let me ask you first, Dr. Palmer, how did such a comprehensive study take shape and come to be?
Well, all of the authors are very dedicated scientists who have expertise in specific areas that are relevant to the issue of mountaintop mining. And it became clear to myself and to my close collaborator, Dr. Bernhardt, that the relevant science related to the issue of mountaintop mining had not been brought together in a way that could deeply analyze what was available out there, what we know and what we don't know, using the peer-reviewed literature. And so we contacted those experts from hydrology, toxicology, public health, et cetera, that could work together to analyze existing data and anything that had been peer-reviewed to ask, what do we know about the impacts of mountaintop mining environmentally and in terms of health, if there are impacts, and what would we find? And so we set out to do that. It took us about 6 months to complete the analysis of the existing peer-reviewed studies, as well as to analyze a recently obtained data set that we had on water chemistry.
Was there a great deal of data out there for your analysis in terms of those pre-existing peer-reviewed studies?
It depends on which aspect of the issue that you look at. There is a fairly extensive amount of data available on water chemistry that has not been brought to the forefront to a large extent in some of the more accessible peer-reviewed literature. But much of this information exists in very different sources, again, all of the peer-reviewed science journals, that had not been brought together. And that is essentially what we did with this particular study.
Well, since this does bring together so many different fields, Dr. Palmer, if you would sort of take the lead on this and guide us through the process of what you've discovered, let's start with your particular field of expertise, and then we will move to Dr. Hendricks, Dr. Bernhardt, and Dr. Lemley, because what I get from reading this is that there is no aspect of anything that was studied within your research that mountaintop removal does not have a rather pernicious effect on. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's a very fair statement. And I should say at the outset that, first of all, this research was that we did was extensively peer-reviewed. It's probably the most critical peer-review process I've ever been to in my nearly 30-year career in science. Authors that are involved here, most of us have never met one another or worked together. None of the authors are advocates for the mountaintop mining, and in fact, we had to sign statements before the journal Science would even consider our submission to them to indicate that we were not supported by any particular group, nor did we have any preconceived ideas about what direction this should take. My own area of expertise is in mitigation and stream restoration, and that's how I first got involved in this, was looking at to what extent do the kinds of approaches that are used to mitigate for any potential impact support, how are they supported by current science? Is it up to date with what's going on in restoration ecology and so forth? And it became very clear to me quickly that the methods that are being used or proposed to mitigate for the impact are not only ineffective, but some of them are actually outside what I would consider the science of restoration ecology. I'll just speak very briefly about the areas that for the authors that aren't present with us right now, and that is we brought in Dr. Bill Schlesinger, who's the president of the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, a National Academy member who's an expert on forest biogeochemistry and soils and reclamation, and reached conclusions based on his analysis of existing data that that regrowth of vegetation is not only very sparse on virtually every site that has been looked at, but that forest regrowth and full recovery to the level of pre-mining conditions for the forest would be on the order of 10,000 years. So we also had a hydrologist, Dr. Keith Eshelman, who's done extensive research on the effect of mining, surface mining on hydrology, and it's very clear that the peak flood and the magnitude and timing of floods increases very significantly in streams and waterways that are left below mining sites. And then I think it would probably make sense to me now to turn it over to some of my co-authors that are present here to talk a little bit about their findings, and I should say some of them have spent many, many years looking into this issue, unlike some of the work that I have done. So I think I'll start with turning it to Dr. Bernhardt from Duke University, who's a biogeochemist and has looked very closely at the chemical and water quality impacts of this issue.
Okay, great. Dr. Bernhardt, thank you, first of all, for joining us. It's a pleasure to meet you at this attenuated distance, and I really appreciate the work that you have done. If you would, please, just give us an overview of what your findings were.
Okay, so this is Emily Bernhardt. I'm a professor of biology at Duke University, and I've been really interested in the effects of mountaintop mining on aquatic ecosystems, and most of my work to date has been looking at how land use changes in watersheds affect stream chemistry, and how we can use stream chemistry to tell us something about the way the watershed is working or not working. So what I did in preparation for this study was to first synthesize the literature on what we know so far about mountaintop mining impacts, and second, try to get new data from the West Virginia DEP about what the water quality impacts really are on the ground right now. And so I guess there are a few things that are sort of my summary from those analyses. The first is that I think the most well-understood and least contentious issue associated with mountaintop mining is that we are, in fact, destroying streams that are buried in overburden from mining activities or converted into sediment ponds. And the best and most conservative estimate to date is that over 1,500 miles of streams in the Appalachians have been destroyed as a result of mountaintop mining. So this means that we've basically lost those ecosystems. And there's been a lot of attention to this in terms of regulations and policy.
Well, I'm loath to interrupt, Dr. Bernhardt, but when you say lost, I take it that you're using a very concise scientific approach to the word, insofar as lost means gone forever. I mean, is that what you mean?
I mean, they're gone for the future of our generation and subsequent generations, for as far down as we can imagine. So when you bury a stream in hundreds of meters of unconsolidated rock, that stream doesn't exist anymore. And I don't think anybody argues with that at all. And in fact, it's a big part of the mitigation of current permitting, is that that has to be compensated for. And I guess what we argue with as experts on restoration, both Margaret and I are that current techniques to basically build new streams on old mine soil are completely insufficient to in any way compensate us for the loss of those really important ecosystems. We can talk more about that if you want, but I think I'd like to move on to what I think are the less discussed issues associated with mountaintop mining. That's an important part of the permitting process and been an important part of the legal challenges to mountaintop mining. But in addition to that, there are these downstream effects of mountaintop mining that are very clear from the data we put together in this paper, and that you have a whole lot of rock that has basically been pushed into the valley. You now have large amounts of rock surface area available for weathering, and that results in the production of large quantities of sulfate, calcium, magnesium, and trace metals that then contribute to very high conductivity, high total suspended solids, and toxicity for downstream ecosystems. And so what we did is gather data on more than 1,000 streams in West Virginia that were sampled by the West Virginia DEP, showing that the more sulfate you see in the stream, and we can tie sulfate very directly to the extent of mining activity in the watershed, the more sulfate you see in the stream, the more the higher the concentrations are of associated trace metals, and the lower the diversity of the invertebrate community. And you probably see a lot of press on the issue of mayflies versus miners.
Yes.
Mayflies, very sensitive insects living in streams. And I think regardless of what you hear about mayflies for their own sake, they are really canaries in the coal mine, if you will, in terms of what this pollution is doing to the health of these ecosystems, the quality of this water, not just for the mayflies, but for the people that are drinking this water, eating fish out of this water, and spending time recreating.
Well, and because they are, in fact, a marker species, are they not?
They are a very important indicator, and they're used as such throughout the United States as measures of ecosystem health and of water quality.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Say then that the next sort of pieces of this are that one of the things that's being ignored is the cumulative impact. So every single additional mine that occurs in the watershed is going to contribute additional pollutants. And so we have this additive effect. Every new mine you add adds new trace metals, new sulfates, new calcium, new magnesium, new conductivity issues, which all contribute to pollution of downstream rivers. And the evidence that exists right now suggests that that's not going to stop for anytime in the near future. So we're talking about decades of persistent pollution by sulfate and associated trace metals coming out of these mining sites. So it's both cumulative, it's resulting from every single mine that you add in a watershed, and persistent over time. I think Dennis Lindley can speak specifically to the most well-understood constituent within that pollution, which is selenium.
Indeed, because I think selenium should be a very important part of our conversation this evening. Simply because there's been a lot of debate around it as to whether or not it's even that dangerous. I personally am bamboozled by the idea that someone would think that it isn't, but that argument has certainly been made within the mining community. Doctor, as you looked at these the impacts on these streams, and the downstream effects, what is there any way of quantifying what distance downstream actually means?
That's a really great question, and I wish we had better data than we do about that. There has not been a comprehensive analysis of the extent of mining, and there's been no attempt to associate the sampling done by the West Virginia DEP with distance from valley fills or mining activity. So that is definitely a shortcoming of the data set as it exists today. I can tell you anecdotally, and I think Dennis can expound upon this, that there certainly is evidence that valley fills lead to significant biotic degradation kilometers downstream, and pretty, really, probably the strongest evidence is from the Mud River terms of selenium contamination in a reservoir more than 12, 15 kilometers downstream of the Hobet mine. That's probably the best studied current longitudinal impact of mountaintop mining. I don't think that's going to be unique if more studies are done.
Well, in the final analysis, are we using, perhaps the best way to put it would be, are we engaging in wishful thinking when we actually talk about terms like mitigation based on the research that you have released?
I would say that the mitigation within the permits that I've seen has been focused on building habitat, building new stream habitat, or trying to recreate the vegetation. And in both of those attempts, there are serious constraints to be able to accomplish anything. So I'm most familiar with the stream mitigation work, and I haven't seen any evidence that we can even get water to be in these channels, much less make them be functioning stream ecosystems.
That's rather a damning statement, Doctor.
Margaret wants to expound on that.
Well, I was just going to say, this is Margaret Palmer, that one of the important points is that even if you could get all of the vegetation to grow back, that is the native forest, there's no evidence that this is the case, you still will have the water quality issues downstream. And I think this might be a good time, Bob, to consider us hearing from Dr. Limley about some of those serious issues, but I'll leave it to you.
No, I think you're absolutely correct, Dr. Palmer. Dr. Limley, could you address this?
Yes, I've spent over 30 years investigating the effects of selenium from coal mining and a lot of other sources, for that matter, on aquatic systems. And the situation with mountaintop mining is very interesting and very dangerous. Selenium is a deadly poison to fish and wildlife. It doesn't take very much to start a process of bioaccumulation in the aquatic food chain. And the end result is that it accumulates in fish tissues and it causes reproductive failure. It essentially passes from adults to the offspring and their eggs. And when those eggs hatch, the young fish are deformed and distorted in a variety of ways. They may be missing eyes, they may have deformed heads, their spines may be twisted out of shape, and those young fish will die. And what we're seeing in West Virginia, specifically with the Hobet mine complex, is that kilometers downstream, the waters from that mine are actually causing bioaccumulation of selenium in a reservoir and causing deformities in the fish. And that's one of the few locations where there's actually any monitoring data for fish whatsoever. So as we begin to look further, and I think this was pointed out, that we need better comprehensive monitoring and information on lots of these sites so we can gain a better handle on what's actually going on. But what we do know is that from a variety of these sites, we have water concentrations of selenium that are high enough to cause problems in the fish in those streams and reservoirs downstream of the mines. We don't have good monitoring data to indicate what the actual spatial distribution of the elevated selenium might be in the fish tissues. But we know that selenium is highly toxic to fish, and it doesn't take very much to accumulate to a level that can cause serious problems in the fish.
Is there an issue of transference into the human population, Doctor?
Yes, there is. Actually, there is a consumption advisory in effect for 2010 for the state of West Virginia for streams and reservoirs downstream of some of the mountaintop mining complexes. So there is a recognition that, in fact, the transfer of selenium into humans through the diet or through consumption of sport fish is a hazard in West Virginia.
To what extent, so far we've discussed surface water, flowing water issues. Does this also percolate into the water table itself?
Yes, it does, and that raises another issue in terms of long-term effects and cumulative effects, because not only is it an immediate concern in terms of selenium leaching out of the waste rock piles, the valley fills, but percolation into groundwater would essentially create a plume of potentially toxic levels of selenium that could subsequently leach or transport itself into surface waters for a long, long period of time.
With that being the case, do you have any within your data, Doctor, Are you able to quantify as a function of time how long these selenium events have been entering watersheds?
Well, we don't have any good information from eastern sites in terms of in terms of West Virginia specifically, because most of these mines are relatively young as compared to mine sites in the western states. But from information from those western states, some of those mine spoil sites that are nearly 100 years old are still leaching selenium at very high concentrations. So based on that information, I would predict that the valley fields in West Virginia and other states would continue to essentially leak dangerous concentrations of selenium into waterways for decades, if not centuries, to come.
And are you aware of any realistic mitigation strategies that can prevent this from happening, or is this simply something that West Virginia and Appalachia generally will have to deal with? I'm talking about the stuff that's already happened.
Well, once a spoils pile, in other words, a valley fill, starts to leach selenium, it's absorbing rainwater. It creates its own little mini aquifer, you might say, internally inside the waste dump, and that material is going to continue to generate selenium for a long time. So, in terms of mitigating that, there's really nothing that can be done to stop that. So, it's virtually inevitable.
I asked the question because I have been told personally by representatives of the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection that that their permitting process requires that when selenium concentrations are identified through core sampling and so forth, that they require segregation onto what they refer to as dry areas. Expecting that to keep selenium out of the water supply is unrealistic, if I understand you correctly.
It's absolutely unrealistic because there's virtually no way to assure a dry site in terms of anything short of underlayment with a composite liner, collection of any leachate and treatment of that. Of course, that's not taking place anywhere, so that's a virtual impossibility.
You described the effects on fish, and you've said that there is a transference issue, Dr. Lemley, into the human population. What effects does selenium have on a human being?
Well, it has several potential effects in terms of the things we know that can happen. It creates several toxic effects in terms of loss of hair, loss of nails, poison of internal organs, and at its most extreme, which we don't have clear documentation of, certainly inferring from fish and mammals and birds, we would suspect that there may be a potential for birth defects in young children.
Dear Lord, and as part of this study, then within your field of expertise, are you making an? I understand from what Dr. Palmer said that you entered this, you entered into this study with rather profound and strict guidelines. You know, not advocating. This is real science. This is simple scientific inquiry. But you came to conclusions. Is one of those conclusions the simple fact that mountaintop removal it cannot be, quote-unquote, safely done?
I think that's a fair statement. We don't have any evidence in our research and documentation that suggests that there is a way to do it safely, given the environmental impacts we see.
Bob, this is Margaret Palmer. I just might add that when we started out this study, we really didn't know what direction it was going to take. And what ended up happening is that the authors sort of independently reached the conclusion that the evidence was so overwhelming, it's basically like smoking and cancer, that it's so clear-cut that we took the unusual step of making a policy recommendation. I think this is a good point to segue, though, to Dr. Hendricks, because we've heard, from Dr. Lemley about some of the potential health impacts, but Dr. Hendricks has looked more broadly at population-level consequences of this, so perhaps I could suggest we hear from him.
I think that's a great idea. Dr. Hendricks, welcome to the program, and thank you as well for joining us. As a West Virginian, I am familiar with your work, perhaps more than that of Dr. Lemley's or Dr. Bernhardt's, and I'm also familiar with Dr. Palmer's work. But since your focus, your previous focus has gotten more notice, perhaps here in West Virginia, I am somewhat aware. With that being the preface, and let me just tell you that I live in Fayette County, West Virginia, with my family and our grandchildren. We live near a mountaintop removal site. So it came to me with really quite chilling horror when I read some of your previous findings. Is what you've done with this study an amplification and expansion upon your previous work?
It's more of a summary of what we had done and reported before, but now we're linking it more directly to additional information on the environmental impacts of the mining activity so that we can link the two together. For example, selenium is one of the many elements that are present in trace levels associated with coal, and that can enter groundwater and surface water sources, and that can also be released into the air through the use of explosives and the removal of the overburdened above coal seams in mountaintop mining. We do have a more recent study that we're working on right now that documents that, in fact, there are higher rates of low birth weight infants associated with heavier levels of mining, and that there are higher rates of congenital abnormalities. Dr. Limley had suggested that that might be a result of some selenium exposure like you expect to see in fish, and we do find evidence that is consistent with that possibility. And as the other research has shown before, there is well-established, very clear evidence of higher rates of a number of serious chronic types of health conditions, a cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, kidney disease, some forms of cancer that are related in a dose-response fashion to higher levels of mining activity. Also evidence of higher types of dental problems and poor learning outcomes among children in relationship to more mining activity. So we don't understand all of the links yet between how the environmental impacts work and what the health outcomes are, but the evidence is extremely suggestive and accumulating and quite strong, I think, that health outcomes among people that live in mining areas are negatively impacted by activities of the mining industry.
Dr. Hendricks, when you say mining activities within the context of this discussion in this paper, are you limiting yourself exclusively to mountaintop removal mining activities, or is this broader in terms of the general universe of coal mining in Appalachia?
I think the effects are partly a consequence of mountaintop mining and other forms of surface mining because of the greater disturbance that takes place for surface water and also for air quality around those mining activities. But I also think that there are other aspects of the industry where we have some pretty good information that there is also environmentally compromised air or water quality around coal processing facilities, for example, and around some of the transportation activities. It's difficult to try to tease out effects of one specific type of activity compared to another because they're all so closely interrelated geographically. But I think the evidence is pretty clear that different components of the activity have effects. So it's not all mountaintop mining, no. I think it is partly that, but also partly other aspects of the industry.
If I may ask you, Dr. Hendricks, for someone who lives, say, near an active site where there is ongoing blasting on a day-to-day basis, what sorts of toxins, what sorts of chemicals are they being exposed to?
Well, that's going to depend on what they use in the explosives themselves. Those can include a number of types of fuels and chemical compounds. It can also include whatever is in the overburden itself, which can vary from site to site. So it's difficult to say with certainty based on the information that we have now, but it would be a combination of whatever was in the rock in the soil above the seams plus whatever is used in the explosives.
And suffice to say on a general basis, those things that you're describing are not good for human consumption?
Yes, there's plenty of evidence that a variety of trace elements that are present in and around coal are either toxicants or carcinogens, and that some of the chemicals that are used in explosives and also in the coal processing and the transportation activities are also harmful to human health. That's clearly established.
You also describe effects in coal communities, and I just asked you a question about someone living right next to an active site. Similar to my previous question about what downstream means, is there data to suggest how far is there a safe distance one may be from a mountaintop removal site?
Well, from the perspective of potential water exposures, I don't know that there would be if there's transport down whatever that watershed is to where people are living and where their wells might be. From an air quality perspective, I think it's probably more localized. We've done some air quality assessments where we've taken some measures at varying distances from either a mountaintop site or from a processing facility or from a truck haul route. And you can see pretty clearly that the levels of particulate matter are highest nearest the site. And when you get to about a mile away, they start to approach more like background levels. So I would say within a mile probably for the radius of air disturbance.
And also as we talk about impacts, I'm being reminded by one of our listeners in our chat room who asks, beyond the actual extraction process itself, what about the impacts of the so-called washing of the coal or coal ash itself? Is there any way to quantify a cumulative impact on human health population or human populational health?
I think the washing process is probably one of the most critical, personally, because it involves a variety of activities. It involves crushing coal, transporting coal, and that can create localized air disturbances, and it also contaminates a large quantity of water, both with the impurities present in the coal itself, as well as with the chemicals used in the cleaning process. These impurities, as we know, are then treated in some way. They're held in slurry impoundment ponds, or they're injected underground, where interface with water sources can also occur.
So if
cumulative impact, it's just very difficult to separate out one activity A from B from C because they're so closely interrelated. But that remains an important piece of work that needs to be done.
So in essence, if you are, for instance, like me, living near active or formerly active mountaintop removal sites, you've got kids, you got grandkids, schools near these sites. Is there anything that an individual can do to try to protect themselves against these impacts?
Try to treat your water system if you're on a private well. Put in filters that will handle metals. Boiling water is not sufficient for something like this. Change the air filters in your home as often as you need to. Change the water filters for your water supply. If you can, consider moving away.
That's scary. Dr. Hendricks, thank you very much. And let me ask generally of the panel, there is a sentence in the report that sort of jumped off the page at me toward the very end of the report. It's a small sentence, and it simply says, regulators should no longer ignore rigorous science. Implicit in that statement is, at least as I read it, the allegation that rigorous science has been heretofore ignored. Is that the case? Is that your assertion with the report?
I might comment on that. This is Dennis Lindley. In the instance of one mine in particular, the Environmental Protection Agency has had aquatic life criteria for selenium for many years. And, of course, that is a threshold beyond which some enforcement regulations or enforcement actions should take place. In the case of the Hobbit mine, during the period 2005 to 2007, that one mine complex was in violation of water quality criteria 600 times. And yet no enforcement action or regulatory enforcement was imposed by EPA or the state. So that in itself is just one example of how regulatory controls have failed in terms of policy and enforcement.
And as you note, that's one mine. And I recently sat in on an appeal board hearing down in Charleston, where I heard counsel for the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection state on the record to the court, if we shut down every mountaintop removal site because of water quality violations, we wouldn't be able. We'd have to shut them all down. At this point, it seems to me, if I read you all correctly, you're saying that there is no way that any regulatory scheme can come up with sufficient safeguards to prevent the sort of things that you've identified from happening. Is that correct?
Yes, I think you got it exactly correct. There's no evidence that water quality can be protected with current mining practices.
And Bob, we are actually at a point where we're about to lose our battery power here.
Well, I was going to close off with you, Doctor, and thank you in advance for the time that you've taken. And I've already talked to your assistant, Dr. Palmer. I'll be providing a copy of this recording. The recorded version of this to her for y'all's use.
I would like to make one last comment, and that is that it's important for the listeners to know that we have responded to every single inquiry for an interview.
Wonderful. That is inspiring, because it tells me that you understand the gravity of this situation. One last question. Where do you go from here? Is this a beginning point, or is this fully self-contained and the work is over?
I don't think the work is over. I think we're going to see a lot more on this. I think the important point we want to make is that this is basic science we're doing, and that the authors that are involved have no vested interest one way or another in the outcome of this. We're simply looking at the science and trying to provide the information that we hope will inform policies. This administration has been very clear that they want science to inform policy, and that's what we're trying to provide.
Well, I thank you very much, and I have a great admiration for real science, which this represents. And I know you've got to catch planes and so forth, and I wish you safe travels in miserable weather. And the very best, and thank you all for the time you've taken both this evening and in putting this study together. I hope it will be put to good use. I sincerely do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and good evening.